May I welcome you on behalf of the director to the annual Martin White Memorial Lecture. For those of you who may not know, this lecture is given every year, but it rotates between the Royal Institute of International Affairs, LSE, and the University of Sussex. They are the three institutions where Martin White made a very strong intellectual mark. At Chatham House, Martin White made important contributions to the surveys of international affairs, and he wrote there his volume on power politics. At the LSE, his main contribution during his lifetime was as a great teacher, an inspiring teacher, whose seminal lectures on international theory served as the basis for a major work which was published posthumously and edited by Mrs. Gabriella White, who I'm very pleased to see here today with members of her family, and Brian Porter. And then from the LSE, Martin White went on to the University of Sussex, where he was the founding dean of European Studies and launched a course in what one might call European civilizations. Now, our distinguished speaker this evening, Professor Stanley Hoffman, would not think it presumptuous of me if I described him as being within the intellectual tradition which Martin White followed. Certainly, he's a student of history and of ideas, and indeed comes from Europe. He was born in Vienna. He spent a formative period in France, studying and teaching in Paris. And then since 1955, he has been at Harvard, where he is now the Paul and Catherine Budenweiser University Professor. His list of major works are voluminous, but they do indicate a continuing interest in affairs at this side of the Atlantic and the other side. And indeed, it's the convergence of those two interests which are going to form the subject of his lecture this evening. So may I ask you to welcome Professor Stanley Hoffman, who's going to give the Martin White Memorial Lecture on the subject of Europe and the United States in world affairs.
Thank you very much for this very kind introduction. Having spent a great deal of time unfortunately, in hospitals in recent months, these flowers remind me a little bit too much of my presence there, but it is wonderful to find them, even if the weather in London is more like March than it is like June. Well, I have taken my instructions seriously. I was told to talk about the United States and Europe in world affairs, so I'm going to talk first in fairly general terms about world affairs, then say a few things about American foreign policy in this present international system, then talk about the European Union's condition, if you like, and end with a few remarks about the future of U.S.-European relations. But before I launch into this talk, I would like to express my gratitude to Mrs. White for being here. And I want to say that I consider myself, although nobody has appointed me to it, an honorary member of the British School of International Relations. Long may that British school live. Do not let it be submerged either by the mathematicians who tell us that you don't need to know any country or any part of the world in order to theorize about it, and don't let it be submerged by the postmodernists who tell you that everything is debatable, everything is relative, nothing is certain, and everything can be deconstructed. Okay, now let me begin with... It's a strange field, a very strange field. The only thing which is being relentlessly driven out of it is the study of politics. Anyhow, Let me begin with some remarks about what I would call not really the international system, but the world political system, and the reason for it will become clear in a second. Traditionally, the study of international relations has focused on the states, largely under the influence of the realists, from Thucydides on. But it seems to me that today's world political system is actually much closer to the vision which liberals had in the 18th and 19th century, with their belief in the gradual reduction or taming of power by transnational links established by individuals across borders. Of course, there's one major difference between the present world and the liberal vision. The liberals thought that there would be a kind of final harmony, and we now know that there isn't any in sight. When one looks today at international or world politics, it seems to me useful to distinguish a number of different levels. The first one is the level of the world political economy, which sometimes, as we've noticed again with the so-called Asian crisis, seems to have a will of its own, and which is itself a mix of public, state, and private actors. Now, this world political economy seems to result in enormous losses of what my former colleague Robert Cohen has called operational sovereignty for the states. And they have lost, in effect, control over a great deal of their economy and of their monetary autonomy. And this loss of operational sovereignty by the states has not been compensated by any corresponding amount of international regulation. So that we are dealing with a world economy which is to a very large extent out of control. The other effect of this world political economy could be called the permanent redistribution of inequality. Both inequalities among states and inequalities within states. This is one of the reasons why what has also emerged is a second level of activity for lack of a better word, I will call people power. The power exerted by people within or across states. I already mentioned the role that individuals and groups play in the world economy, but people power, as we have observed again in Indonesia just a few days ago, also has the capacity to threaten many regimes or even the existence of a number of states, hence the decomposition of so many of them in recent years. Finally, of course, there is the traditional state level, but it is only one among those three. And this is why so many of the analyses of world politics to which we are used are inadequate. Given those different levels, what we do find is an enormous proliferation in the scope and nature of conflicts. We have, first of all the conflicts provided by the world economy and fueled by the instantaneous nature of communications. These conflicts are sometimes interstate. I come at this point from France, and France seems to be constantly in collision with the United States over a number of economic issues. But in addition to interstate conflicts, we also have to take into account the effects of massive capital movements, which in recent years have succeeded in overwhelming a large number of states in all continents. Secondly, we find a very traditional interstate conflict. We have one in the news today between Eritrea and Ethiopia. And of course, in this area of interstate conflicts, we have all the problems raised by the spread of weapons of mass destruction. And these interstate conflicts, while they don't have the death life and death nature that the Cold War seemed to have for so long are nevertheless increasingly serious, precisely because the disciplining quality which the superpowers had in their respective zones of influence is gone. Then, next to this, we have one very interesting and somewhat unexpected category of conflicts. I would say it's the collapse of the floor on which states have been performing, or the destruction of many failed and troubled states, or their decomposition, so that state sovereignty is, in a sense, threatened both from above by the world economy and from below by this capacity of many of the people in the world to dismantle or destroy states. Now, the reason why I went through this recital of fairly well-known facts is simply to indicate that the scope and the nature of these conflicts are such that no single state, and not even a superpower such as the United States, can really control them adequately. That's one important characteristic. Looking at the world in terms of poles of power does not get you very far. Even the dominant or hegemonic power cannot control all of this. And the second reason for mentioning this is that there exists today, I think, a problem of collective steering. If one superpower cannot introduce a modicum of order in the world economy and in world politics, one might expect some kind of concert of powers, major powers or regional powers, to substitute. But the world today, it seems to me, looks more like the world of 1919, when there was, again, no particularly strong steering group, partly because, well, one power went home, the United States, another one, Russia, went through the agonies of its revolution, and England and France had been seriously weakened, even if they were victors in World War I. So I think the world today looks more like 1919 than like 1815, when there was, at least for some years, a concert of powers trying to bring some kind of order into the world. This being said, let's turn to the situation of the superpower, the United States. Here, what I find most striking is two sets of contrasts. The first one, which of course is not unfamiliar, is the contrast between rhetoric and reality, which could also be called the contradiction or the contrast between the Albright eloquence and the Powell doctrine. Many Americans, and not only the Secretary of State, like to reassure themselves in this world which is so hard to control by explaining that America is the indispensable nation, and as she put it in a particularly unfortunate sentence, sees farther than others. Now, there are many areas of the world in which this would be a slightly disputable, let us say. So there is this rhetoric which one hears a lot of, particularly in what is left in the media of interest in foreign affairs, which is not very much. But, you know, nobody can work without us, we are indispensable, nobody can act if we don't lead them, especially not the Europeans, who are, as everybody knows, both impotent and incompetent. Fine. But next to this, you have what used to be the Weinberger Doctrine, which then became the Powell Doctrine, which has now become the Cohen Doctrine, according to which the most important thing for the United States is to make sure that whatever it does succeeds, and please don't undertake something if you're not absolutely sure, A, that it succeeds, and B, that you can get out of it at minimal cost if it doesn't succeed. It's what I have called somewhere the doctrine of combatant immunity, limited to American soldiers. Now, obviously, to have to live with those two sets of notions in one's head at the same time creates a case of what psychologists call cognitive dissonance. But contrary to what psychologists believe, most people live very well with cognitive dissonance. The second contrast is between the activism which the United States in recent years, and not only, but particularly under the Clinton regime, the activism which the United States has displayed in world economic affairs, where it does behave as a hegemon, and the extraordinary reluctance the United States has shown to perform a similar kind of activism on the strategic and diplomatic stage. I think the explanation of these contrasts is not very difficult to find. In the economic area, certainly for the government of the United States and for a great part of the business and financial community, there is a well-defined economic interest, which is the opening of borders to American goods, American capital, American services. Whereas if one looks at the strategic and diplomatic stage, with the unexpected disappearance of the threat, the obvious threat that had been constituted by the Soviet Union, what the American interest is far from obvious. And even for people who believe that in this or that part of the world there is a clear interest, the hierarchy of interests is not clear, so that in the absence of any one overwhelming threat, there is a great deal of hesitation. The second reason for this contrast is that in this strategic and diplomatic area, there is in the United States a great deal of battle fatigue. The United States, as it sees it, manned the barricades for a very long period indeed, let's say from 1941 to 1989-91. And at present, in the absence of such an overwhelming threat, there is a great deal of turning away from the world stage, returning not to isolationism, that has, I think, become impossible for all kinds of reasons. I think it really died on December 7, 1941, but certainly turning to a situation in which, a condition in which interest in foreign affairs comes last when one asks people what it is that they are worrying about. Now, the effects of these factors have been very important. The first effect is the enormous importance of domestic considerations. One of the problems with many of the analyses of international relations in the past, especially in the somewhat oversimplified versions of realism and neorealism which prevailed in the United States for so long, was the pushing aside of what was inside the black box constituted by each state. Well, one can no longer do this. What we find, for instance, when one looks at domestic forces playing a role in foreign affairs in America, is, for instance, an increased opposition of some groups in the United States to some of the effects of free trade. Only a few years after the launching of NAFTA, it isn't clear at all to everybody in the United States that it is or will be beneficial. There's one wing of the Democratic Party which expresses the reservations that quite a number of workers in sectors which have not benefited from that expansion of trade and investment abroad have expressed, Gephardt and company. And some of that opposition is not due exclusively to economic calculations of who lost and who is losing and who is benefiting from this enormous expansion of American economic power in the world. Some of that opposition is due or results from moral considerations. I'm thinking of the various groups, people, whatever, who think that the push to integrate China in the world economy has left the concern for human rights far behind. A second aspect of this extraordinary importance of domestic forces has been something which is far from new. I mean, it's been there for a long time, but it is particularly visible at this point in a world in which there isn't a single threat to discipline them, the role of ethnic pressure groups. Not only because of the direct influence of lobbies which go out and pressure, let us say, to support Greece against Turkey or to support Israel against Arabs who do not happen to have any lobby in the United States, but also in the form of the government anticipating the reactions of ethnic groups. And I can't help but feel that in the decision made rather abruptly by President Clinton to expand NATO, considerations of the political power of the Polish voters were not insignificant, to use an understatement, because the decision was announced in Chicago and confirmed in Detroit, or vice versa, which are not cities in which Poles are missing. The last manifestation of this importance of the domestic factor is quite simply the difficulty of waging an effective foreign policy when there is a political deadlock. As I said a few minutes ago, I'm presently for a little while in France, and the French are indulging in one of their favorite exercises, which is to talk about possible constitutional reform. They have, as you may realize, had the same constitution for 40 years, which for France is something perfectly un-French. Yes, you will tell me that that of the Third Republic lasted longer, but as the French would say, en quel état, in what condition? So there are now all kinds of discussions, and many very distinguished people argue that it would be good if France revised its constitution and adopted a purely presidential system. And perhaps because I've lived in the United States now for over 40 years, I think this would be a perfect recipe for disaster. In part because the French do not have the occasional tendency toward compromise, which incidentally is not always visible in the present American party scene. There have been better periods from the point of view of accommodation between the parties and compromise. And it's precisely because of this that it is very difficult to have a coherent and consistent foreign policy at a time when the current administration's policy in the Arab-Israeli conflict, which nobody can call terribly coercive against Israel, is being denounced by the Speaker of the House in Israel, since he called Mrs. Albright an agent of the Palestinians. That shows that at this point, the opposition party, if one can still call the Republicans the opposition party, because after all they do control Congress, which means the purse, is playing a game which simply consists of opposing fairly systematically or trying to run faster than the government. And that, again, poses very big difficulty when you try to define a coherent policy. Another manifestation of these difficulties, move beyond the problem of domestic factors, is the considerable ambivalence toward the use of force. The United States surely has the most effective, the best armed, the most advanced technologically set of armed forces in the world. But on the whole, there is a great preference for displaying force rather than using it. I think this was very visible in the crisis with Iraq earlier this year, when the reluctance of the administration to go beyond a rather formidable bearing of very sharp teeth was very visible. And I must add that when the administration was, in a sense, saved from having to use force by the services of the Secretary General of the UN, the administration was singularly are ungracious about having been saved from doing what it said it would like to do, but was clearly not at all willing to do. So you have this preference for displays of force rather than force, and I think that we may see the same in the case of Kosovo. And there's also a preference which has become almost ritualistic for economic sanctions over military ones. As a good conventional liberal, I used to believe that there's nothing worse than the use of force and economic sanctions are nicer. I think I've changed my mind, because economic sanctions have a way of striking people who are themselves the victims of tyrants or of governments that they do not control. We've seen this in many instances, and are sometimes an effective and limited but well-calculated use of force can be, in fact, far preferable to years of sanctions, which don't get you any closer to your political objectives, but succeed mainly in killing innocents. Finally, I think a last characteristic of American diplomacy at this point, and this is something which I think is not always very well perceived, at least on the other side of the channel, is that the United States is more concerned with preventing others from substituting themselves for the U.S. than with really driving others or leading them. There was a few years ago a paper prepared by the Pentagon which created something of a stir until the Pentagon explained that it was only a preliminary or preparatory paper, but which I think was a little bit more than that, and which essentially defined what should be the goal of the United States in this phase of world affairs, and that goal ought to be to prevent any other power or alliance of powers from challenging the number one position of the United States. If you have a safe number one position that nobody challenges, you don't have to do anything much. And it seems to me that when one looks at something like NATO expansion again, it was much more a desire to prevent the Europeans from launching into an autonomous defense system which might sometimes act without the U.S. in effect, than it was a desire to restore the kind of American hegemony over the Europeans that it exerted with the consent of most of the Europeans as long as the Cold War was going on. And another example of this antagonism to people who might substitute themselves for the United States is the considerable coolness which has developed over the years between the United States administration and the United Nations, because the United Nations is somewhat unpredictable, Security Council as well as the General Assembly, and could, at times, if one isn't very careful about it, drag the United States into moves that the U.S. Considers to be too risky. Now, the result of all of this is that very often the United States gives one the impression of being a somewhat clumsy giant. Proud of its giant status, but with enormous difficulties in at least four different categories, I would say. First of all, a great difficulty in shaping a strategy about the future of Russia, in which most of the moves have been really rather short run. Or the future of the relationship with Japan, where again it's very often short-term considerations that prevail. Secondly, difficulty in coping with the effects of the rise of China. I think that when it comes to China, there is an American policy. I just heard this afternoon the speech the president gave today to defend his trip to China. It was an extremely effective speech. Very well argued, and there clearly is a policy. I wouldn't say entirely the same thing about policy either towards Russia or towards Japan. But I think what has been somewhat neglected in shaping that policy was a consideration of the effects which this policy of engagement with China has had on some of China's neighbors, and particularly on India, which has barely mattered in American foreign policy for a very long time, indeed. Hence the air of total surprise with which the Indian nuclear explosions were received in Washington. And it's not just the fault of the CIA, it was the fault of the administration as a whole. Thirdly, the difficulty the United States often shows, despite its superpower status, in handling effectively even states which are the clients of the United States, whether it is Israel or Pakistan. And finally, a difficulty in revising in what is would be called in America, where the vocabulary sometimes becomes bizarre, a proactive policy, in revising policies which are obsolete or frayed at the edges. Most people realize that the American policy towards Cuba or the American policy toward Iran may have been justified some years ago, but needs serious changes. It's not going to happen very quickly. And if one looks at how long the United States stuck with Mobutu in Zaire and with Suharto in Indonesia, sure, they changed at the end, but after the writing had already been on the wall for a little while, one sees how this giant, who sees farther than others, how myopic it can be at times in an emergency. So these are, it seems to me, a few things one can say. I'm sure there are positive things one can say as well. But I think it is important to put in context what it is that handicaps American policy. It's not only the fragmentation of power among so many agencies in Washington. It is this extraordinary importance of a number of domestic paralyzing factors. It is the battle fatigue after the Cold War, and so on. If we turn from there to Europe, I think the problem with Europe is that it is, in world affairs, what I would call a semi-power. Certainly, the European Union is a very powerful bloc in international economic affairs and has handled those quite effectively. Indeed, in a number of recent instances, the last GATT round, as well as the recent agreement, which for practical purposes circumvents the laws passed by the US Congress, which were trying to penalize European enterprises doing business in countries that the US Congress does not like Libya or Cuba or Iran, the European Union has succeeded in getting concessions from the United States, which is indeed a considerable achievement for a union which is made of so many members with rather different economic interests. But I would add immediately that people who believe that when it comes to international negotiations, the United States has an automatic advantage over the Europeans because the Europeans are so many and divided, even within the common external policy of the EU, whereas the United States is a single actor, underestimate considerably the multitude of actors in American foreign economic policy. It's not only multiple agencies, it's multiple interest groups, so that the scene isn't any less complicated on the Washington side than it is on the Brussels side. But if one turns from the economic sector to the area of common foreign and defense policy, obviously, and despite all the proclamations about the need for a common European security and foreign policy, repeatedly, Maastricht, Amsterdam a year ago, there has been, in fact, very little progress. It is true that European foreign ministers communicate with each other very much more than they did 15 or 20 years ago, visit each other more, but very little has come out of this. And of course, there are many reasons for this. Many of the smaller countries do not put into a foreign policy and defense the kind of energy they put into the building of a common economic market, or into the creation of a single currency. Germany continues to have a certain number of handicaps, particularly when it comes to sending troops abroad. And Britain and France, as ex-great powers, certainly in foreign affairs, have a certain tendency, which is quite understandable, but which doesn't help the European Union as such, prefer to act as Britain or as France, rather than settling for a kind of lowest common denominator foreign policy. And of course, it is in that area very often that the divergence of interests and calculations has been greatest. Add to this that when one turns from foreign policy to security, there are added complications. For many of the members of the European Union, NATO, under American leadership, remains the most cost-effective institution for common security conceivable. On the issue of the relationship between the West European organization, West European Union, and the European Union, very little progress has been made. Nothing was really accomplished in Amsterdam. And this is one issue on which one finds France at one end, trying to push for a common security organization, Britain at the other end, Germany oscillating in between, but usually when a showdown comes, siding more, at least in the past, with Britain than with France. So in this area, one remains quite deadlocked. And it is sometimes rationalized in Brussels by the argument that the mission of Europe is to be, above all, a civilian power. But obviously, there are handicaps. The separation between a common and often, I repeat, very effective foreign economic policy and the absence of a similar policy with respect to diplomacy and defense is increasingly hard to defend. And yet, when one looks at the texts, at the various revisions of the Treaty of Rome, one continues to see that whereas in foreign economic affairs, it is the Council of Ministers and the Commission which have received the powers which used to be the powers of the states. When it comes to diplomacy and defense, it is still the principle of unanimity which prevails, even if in Amsterdam there is now a possibility to have constructive abstention, a formula which was used by the United Nations many, many years ago when the veto was a major problem. So this is why, next to a superpower which is handicapped in the way I've tried to describe, we find a Europe which is indeed a giant in one respect, but remains a collection of often divergent states when it comes to diplomacy and defense. Let me end with some considerations about the present and the future. In European-American relations, there is a remarkable asymmetry at present. For the Europeans, partly because of the weaknesses of Europe in the strategic diplomatic field, but partly also because in the area where Europe is strong, foreign economic policy, the obvious interlocutor and sometimes obstacle is the United States. For the Europeans, America is at the center of concerns. America is either indeed indispensable, as one has seen in an operation like Bosnia after years of hesitations, tribulations, and escapes, or else, if it isn't indispensable, it is unavoidable. And that means that the United States, for the Europeans, is either omnipresent. It's in NATO, it is in GATT, it is in the World Trade Organization, what have you, or else it is a catalyst for action. On the other hand, for the United States, at this point, Europe is not exactly the major preoccupation.
if there is a major preoccupation, it is Asia. First, it was the growth of Asia, the prosperity of Asia, Asia as an enormous potential market. Now it is the Asian crisis, which could, under certain circumstances, spread to the United States, although I'm both happy to hear and slightly worried to hear Mr. Greenspan tell us that there will be no contagion. I hate those kinds of prophecies. They usually go wrong. It's much safer for a statesman or an academic to be pessimistic, because if he's optimistic and wrong, everybody will remember it. If he's pessimistic and wrong, nobody will remember it. But anyhow, so it is very much Asia. And I think this is buttressed by a phenomenon which many Europeans have observed when they do the ritual round in Washington, which is that the number of people in reasonably high places who have the kind of familiarity with Europe that existed after the war and that in fact lasted for a very long time is no longer there. Many of these people are either dead or are at the stage in which one writes one's memoirs, but they no longer even appear on talk shows. And quite seriously, there isn't at present any equivalent transatlantic class, so to speak. And that contributes to this relative fall of from grace, or fall from importance of Europe in the United States. What are the issues in the near future for between the United States and Europe? I think there are two. One is really a hardy perennial, but it doesn't make it any less important. And that is really the future of the world trading system. There has been a rapprochement between the United States and the Europeans on some issues. I think that the Asian crisis has made American officials start reflecting a little bit more about the dangers of leaving huge areas of international economic affairs without any kind of regulation at all. But on the other hand, there are still a large number of conflictual areas. So far, as you know, in the last GATT round, the United States had to leave out two areas which are important not only to the French, but to many other Europeans as well, agriculture and cultural goods. I mean, should one treat cultural goods the way one treats potato chips? A big issue in there. The Americans do not quite think that this is a great deal of difference. And this, I think, is likely to continue to be a highly controversial issue. We will see where it goes, but I do not believe that the present American position, which was to push this aside, is going to stay that way, precisely because that's the one area of foreign policy where there is as much American activism as we've seen. The other area, which I think is likely to be quite a controversial one, has to do with the future of NATO. We can, if I had more time, one could talk about some of the other implications of the expansion of NATO. But basically, the United States seems to be pushing towards turning NATO from a security organization created for the defense of Europe against threats coming from the outside into an alliance for interventions in world crises, including in domestic world crises, since there is this problem of the collapsing states, under American leadership. And it is fairly clear that when it comes to allowing within NATO the Europeans to attain a degree of autonomy which would allow the Europeans to act with American logistical support, but without any kind of American veto, the Pentagon and much of the State Department do not want to hear about it. Now, I think this is likely to be, and fairly soon, since next year there'll be a discussion about NATO, it's going to be a highly controversial issue. The Europeans so far seem to be moving towards accepting this sort of out-of-area role for NATO, but only if there is a certain amount of autonomy for the Europeans, and only if there is a certain subordination to the United Nations, to the Security Council, which is not something the United States favors. So there'll be more conflict, which means that academics who study European-American relations have a future. A final remark. The fact that Europe is only a semi-power, and the fact that the United States is a handicapped giant, mean that there really is nothing like a steering committee for this world of multiple conflicts. Japan, at this point, has its own crisis and has always been extremely cautious about playing a major diplomatic and strategic role. China's political future of its regime is very uncertain. Russia, all bets are possible. The result is that we have a world without this sort of concert that could try to provide some guidance. The international organizations which exist, many of them are quite weak, lack resources, or are handicapped in one way or in another. The United Nations, particularly when it comes to issues like intervention, timely interventions before genocides come on. So I suspect that the world political system will continue to be a highly troubled one. And when there will be again something like a concert of great powers is very, very hard to guess. Well, thank you very much. What I would like to do is something which I'm told is a violation of ritual, but I wouldn't mind taking a few questions and answering them, or dodging them, depending.
Could I suggest? Now, I leave my thanks to Professor Hoffman after questions. But could I suggest that the questions come first of all from any students who are here? I know you're all students, but I mean those who pay fees.
Well, I must confess, a bit late, to a great weakness. I don't understand anything about international monetary affairs. I can only report on what is being said about them. Let me put it this way. With the exception of Henry Kissinger on the one hand and my Harvard colleague, whose name I systematically forget. Yes, Martin Feldstein. I don't know why I always forget him. And I say on the other hand because their positions are not interchangeable, but both of them are convinced that EMU is going to introduce an extraordinarily important conflictual factor in world affairs. Feldstein has written an article which I thought was perfectly preposterous about how EMU is going to lead to war among the Europeans. It may lead to all kinds of difficulties among the Europeans, but wars usually have different sorts of origins. Kissinger is very consistent. Kissinger in the 70s, when he was a world historical figure, made it very clear that, according to him, it had been a bad idea for past administrations to encourage the Europeans to unite economically and to be rather reluctant to let the Europeans organize their own defense, because he was convinced that when it came to defense, the Europeans could never achieve anything without the Americans anyhow, whereas in the economic realm, they might become a quite formidable rival of the United States. So that in that sense, his prediction that EMU would lead to difficulties and conflict between the U.S. and the Europeans is very much in line with his past opinion. I think what one now finds among American economists is, first of all, there are some who believe that EMU will in fact happen, or they don't quite know what the consequences will be. That's another subject. I mean, will it lead to further European political integration? Will it not? But who think it will happen, and who do not believe it will necessarily, or in the short run, be a terrible challenge for the United States, for the dollar, because it'll take many years for the Europeans to put their own act together in that sense. Ultimately, perhaps, but not immediately. You have others who believe that it just won't work, and therefore it won't be a challenge for the United States, that the Europeans will not be able to stick to the terms of that famous stability pact, that there'll be all kinds of internal crises over countries which do not meet the criteria, over the application of sanctions to those who don't, and that, therefore, the sovereignty, if you like, of the dollar, in a world in which the yen is clearly in trouble and in which the euro will not amount to very much, is not going to be challenged. If you ask me for my own opinion, I can give it to you, but it's perfectly worthless since I don't understand anything about it. I have the very strange belief that the euro will work. With crises, I don't think that the model of the Bundesbank in the long run will go entirely unchallenged, because much of what one is dealing with when one deals with money is highly political. And I wouldn't be surprised if ultimately the more political institutions of the community, of the union, mainly Council of Ministers, will have to have a great deal of say. But that wouldn't be the only area, to put it mildly. But my guess is that once again, there will be a big debate between people for whom the glass is half full and people for whom it's half empty. And that in that area, since so many people have predicted that there wouldn't even be a glass half full is going to be a considerable achievement. But that may be the expatriate European who's talking. I don't know. Yeah. I think that, personally, I think that NATO expansion, I've written somewhere that it was a bad idea whose time had come. I still think it was a bad idea at that, for all kinds of reasons. If one could rewrite history, which one can't, it would have been much better to begin the process of incorporation of those states into the European Union. I'm not saying accepting them fully without transitions. That was not feasible, given their own economic condition. But being less niggardly about it, starting the process, which is going to be a long one anyhow, of negotiation and of exceptions and transitions much, much earlier, having them join the WEU, and then the NATO question could have come much later. I thought at the time that the Partnership for Peace was a very good idea, precisely because it did concern Russia also, and precisely because Russia is such an unknown quantity politically, has such an extraordinarily fragile political system and such a extraordinarily, should I say, shaky or shady form of capitalism at this point, that simply to deal with that problem by saying, oh, they'll adjust anyhow, what else can they do? And anyhow, we keep telling them that we do it for their own good. Americans have a great tendency to believe that if you tell somebody else that what the Americans do is for their own good, other people will believe it. They've been telling the French for years that everything the Americans find objectionable in French policy is really in the French interest. And they still haven't bought it, strangely enough. And not only because they are arrogant, cocky, and obsessed by the past. So I thought it was a bad idea. And I can't help feel, and here I'm editorializing, that it was done for a mix of two sets of reasons. One, quite powerful with the president, is the one I mentioned, appealing to the Polish vote in the United States at the time which happened, as usual in America, to coincide with an election. As you know, there are elections all the time. The other one was the desire of some officials, one in particular, whom I will not name, but who is Richard Holbrooke, to show that it is still the United States that matters in European affairs. I think he has displayed very often this belief that I mentioned earlier, that the Europeans left to themselves will never amount to anything. And the integration of those countries into NATO was a way of linking them directly to the United States, which I think, as a good practitioner of power politics, he thought was a very good idea. I don't think it was a good idea, but you know, now it's a bit late. Now the next debate will be about whether to continue to expand it. And that'll be another factor in American politics in the next 3 or 4 years. Much of that, I think, will depend on how costly the integration of the three countries actually turns out to be. If the price is as low as the Pentagon tells us, then I think there will be an effort to do more. If it's more expensive, Congress may balk. Who knows? Yes, really?
Yes.
Now, wait a minute. There was just a young woman behind you. You're next. Yeah. Which internal conflict where?
In Africa, or in
India. On U.S.-European relations? I don't know. I really don't know. It's too soon. I don't think that anybody has yet succeeded in calculating all the consequences on the economies of Europe or the United States of what's happening there. I don't know. I think much will depend on whether the Japanese are able to stop the fall of the yen and restore some of their economy, and much will depend on whether the contagion spreads to China or not. So I just don't know. You have such wonderful economists in this country. I mean, nobody has analyzed the world economy more effectively than Susan Strange. Ask them, not me. Yes, sir.
Given that you're addressing an English school and perhaps mm-hmm.
You know, it's very hard to talk about the state in general unless you are giving a course in sociological theory, which I do sometimes, but that's not my activity today, precisely because there are so many different categories of states. Some states are indeed in decline, but they were never very solid states. They never amounted to more than a local tyrant with his gangs, and these are states which collapse fairly easily. You have other states which are quite likely to survive, but in very different conditions. I mean, because they can't act as if they were fully sovereign. They need others to achieve something. So it's very, I think the conception of the 19th century conception of sovereignty as it has been developed by generations of legal analysts is indeed obsolete, but that does not mean that the state as such is condemned to die. Auguste Comte, whom nobody reads anymore, if only because he's unreadable, said somewhere that you can destroy only what you can replace. And we haven't found a replacement for the state. So sure, it's hemorrhaging like mad, above, below, devolution to regional areas, all kinds of things which are very fashionable in political science. But it's still there because there's nobody there to take its place. So I don't think that the state is condemned to disappear. As for world society, yes, there is an international society. It's full of regulations and norms. This is what not only the UN stands for, but you have now a whole world of regulations coming through agreements among transnational private groups. So there is an international society, but it remains a highly conflictual one, which, of course, I think the people in England who wrote about international society knew perfectly well. I think what they were denying was that the world was simply a jungle, a war of all against all, in which only military power mattered. I think both Martin White and Hedley Bull made this abundantly clear. When one talks about international society, one means that there are some common interests and some common norms, but it doesn't mean that it's going to be a harmonious society. And the states, in their different shapes, will need an international society more and more.
Well, Professor Hoffman, many things that I want to thank you for. I think, first of all, for lecturing to the faithful and keeping the faith. Secondly, for assuring us that there's still a future for those who study European-American relations. I'd like to thank you also for your light, humorous touch, but also in the knowledge that it's a veneer on a very deep layer of erudition. And we are really very much in your debt for what has been an intellectual tour d'horizon, and that coupled with an intellectual tour de force. And we very much appreciate your profound observations. Thank you very much, and please come again. Thank you.